Shrink Wrap Radio Number 311, Synchronicity and the Interconnected Universe, with Jungian analyst Joseph Cambray.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jungian analyst Dr. Joseph Cambray, and we'll be discussing his very authoritative book on synchronicity. Joseph Cambray, Ph.D., is president of the International Association of Analytical Psychology. He's the former U.S. editor of the Journal of Analytical Psychology, and he is a faculty member at Harvard Medical School, Center for Psychoanalytic Studies at Massachusetts General Hospital, Psychiatry Department, and adjunct faculty at Pacifica Graduate Institute. His publications include the book of his Fay lectures, Synchronicity, Nature, and Psyche in an Interconnected Universe, and a co-edited book, Analytical Psychology, Contemporary Perspectives in Jungian Psychology, as well as numerous articles. Joe is a Jungian analyst with practices in Boston and Providence, Rhode Island. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Joseph Cambray, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, and I'm glad to get you because I know you're a globetrotter, and you sent me emails from Macau and I think Singapore. And
yeah.
Boy, you're just going all over the place. So it's so good to have you on the show. I've been very interested in synchronicity, both personally and professionally, and have recently done several interviews here on that topic. And it was only recently that I learned about you and your book. And with your book, I feel like at last I found the mother lode on synchronicity.
Well, thank you. Let's see if we can together join in a deeper understanding of it.
Yeah, and I should hasten to mention that the title of your book is Synchronicity, Nature and Psyche in an Interconnected Universe, which in a way tells the whole story. But before
yes.
But before we get into synchronicity, I'd be interested to know more about your background. I gather you were a scientist before becoming a Jungian analyst. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's correct. The first career, before I trained as a psychologist, I was a theoretical chemist.
That's amazing. That's surprising.
Well, actually, in the Jungian community, there are we tend to be a little bit older a community, and people often turn to Jungian analysis later in life, so that people are often coming with a first career in a completely different discipline.
Yes. And at what point in your life did you learn about Jung?
Well, I can remember, I think during my undergraduate years, I took some psychology classes, and there was just a little bit on his theory of the collective unconscious and so forth that I found intriguing. And later on, as I had a little bit of time to explore, I was interested in the history of science, and as a chemist, the turn towards alchemy was a natural place to look for the background of ideas. And then again, I found myself at an interface with Carl Jung, because he was one of the real masters of the psychology of alchemy.
Yeah, and it's interesting to learn about your early interest in the background of science, in the history of science, because that really runs throughout your book. And what drew you that next step to becoming a Jungian analyst?
Well, that was a complex detour on my part. I had finished a PhD and then a postdoc, and within the fields of science, and I was uncertain about whether or not to pursue a tenure track position in chemistry at that point. And so I took a couple of years to travel to Japan. I was there as a visiting scholar at a university, and in that capacity, I began to do a fair bit of Zen meditation, and that opened up a lot of dream material that ultimately led me back yet again to Carl Jung and his theories. And at that's the point at which I felt that what I was internally discovering for myself needed a more full investigation and a commitment. So that's, I think, the defining switch for me to head in the direction of training in psychology and then in Jungian analysis.
Wow, what a fascinating background, and you're nothing if not committed. that really comes through.
Well, yes, I mean, that's, intensity seems to be one of the things in my life.
Yeah, and so finally, you know, we talk about the call in terms of, you know, Jungian psychology and Joseph Campbell. What called you to write this very scholarly book about synchronicity?
Well, it first began, there are two strands. First was the clinical experiences that I had starting in the late 80s and into the early 90s. I had a number of patients who had fairly severe trauma histories, and this sort of event, what Jung would have called synchronicity, seemed to be a common feature of a number of these cases. And I felt I needed to have a fuller grasp of a clinical understanding of these events. And then the parallel and perhaps good fortune at that point was that the work was being done at the Santa Fe Institute on consciousness studies. And these are the people who really spearheaded the movement into complexity theory and emergence. And for the first time, I found in reading their work a link between my scientific background and the psychological interests I had. So that's where the marriage of these two began to come together and why this book in particular had a passion for me.
Okay, great. And of course, I'm wondering if there were synchronicities in the process of writing this book. I would have to think that it would
indeed
have to
there
be.
Were a couple of very strange ones.
Yeah.
It's curious how these things cluster. But when I wrote the first paper, I was wrestling with the whole question of statistics and, the idea of coincidence. When you look at very large numbers, that coincidences are to be anticipated and expected. And so this was in the time shortly after 9/11, and I had to fly to Paris. And two things happened. Once I was in Paris for some meetings, and I was talking with a friend and colleague, Murray Stein, about synchronicity from my ethical point of view. I was interested in the ethics of synchronicity, some philosophical questions. And we were in the midst of that discussion and talking about perhaps arranging a conference on some of these topics. And he asked me if I thought of anyone in particular who might be a bridge person, especially with the psychoanalytic community. And I had recently had some conversations with Anna Maria Rizzuto, who wrote a book, Why Freud Rejected God, and there's a couple of other books of hers that are quite good. And so I was in the midst of telling Murray this, and we were having coffee in the Latin Quarter, when I looked up, and there was Anna Maria Rizzuto walking down the street.
Of course.
And I stood up and said hello to her and introduced her to Murray, and I must admit, she looked at me, it seemed like, as if she'd seen a ghost, and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm here, you know, seeing some colleagues and at some meetings." And in fact, she was herself teaching at the French Psychoanalytic Institute at the time. And of course, we had no notion that one another was in town. But I think the chance encounter on the streets of Paris, where both of us were there for a very short window of time, was particularly meaningful to both of us. And then on the flight home, it was a very large plane. But of course, at that time, nobody wanted to fly. And so this really jumbo jet had about 70 people total on it. And I was a little miffed because I was put next to someone. And I had a lot of work to do, and I was trying to make my way through a lot of written material that I had to process. And the young man next to me was quite charming, and he kept chatting with me. So finally, I set my my work down, and I just decided I would engage with him. Well, it turns out he was a mathematician. And the person that I had been working on, the research that I've been working on with Percy Diaconis and Fred Mosteller, had written this paper on synchronicity and statistics. And it turns out that the man sitting next to me, the young man, his roommate had just gone out to work with Percy Diaconis at Stanford.
So
we had a conversation about the coincidences that were occurring in the context of this flight back from Paris to the U.S. There are more complications to it, but it gives you a feeling of the kind of clustering that starts to happen.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm fascinated by the fact that you were looking into statistics because most, quotes, tough-minded scientists dismiss the idea of synchronicity with an appeal to the statistics of large numbers. I take it that you are not persuaded by that critique.
Well, it's complex because I think in some ways it's the paradigm that you're using. I actually had a conversation about this with several statisticians, and it seems to me that it is a Descartian move that they make when they do that. That is that mind is separated from matter, and that matter behaves statistically, and mind acts with a kind of a different framework, as it were. And if you don't start with that premise, then I think the statistical argument becomes more difficult. And Jung, when he originally wrote the synchronicity essay, in his discussions with Wolfgang Pauli, who was his really almost his co-author in some of these things, they had long discussions about the question of statistics, and both of them felt that statistics were not applicable to unique events. That statistics are really only about large numbers of things, and that if you're framing coincidence within that perspective, what you wash out is the actual unique individual quality of the event. Mm-hmm. That's statistics can't deal with that. And mm-hmm. So I think it's a question of one's understanding of statistics rather than, and the limitations of it rather than simply discarding them.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
We're going to be challenged to get through your book because I'm hoping that we can that we can touch on all five chapters in the time that we have together here. Chapter one is titled Synchronicity, the History of a Radical Idea, and a very fascinating history it is indeed. I was impressed by the way Jung was so earnestly struggling to integrate information from so many different sources, from his own boyhood, from the classical Greeks, from the alchemists, from Chinese Taoist philosophy, from Goethe, from the philosopher Leibniz, from theology, from the parapsychology of J.B. Rhine, and from some of the leading physicists of his time, including Einstein and Pauli and David Bohm. So this was not a casual notion on his part, but one that he was really struggling with earnestly to put on a solid theoretical footing. What can you tell us about that quest?
Well, what's happened since I've written the book is the publication of the Red Book. And I have found that to be really crucial to my understanding of why this was so central a text for Jung in his later life, the synchronicity text. If you'll permit me just a little bit of background there, he starts the Red Book basically out of a set of very powerful experiences he has in 1913 after he's severed ties with Freud and he is moved into private practice. And he has a set of visions, waking visions, that disturb him terribly about Europe filling up with blood. And he is anxious that he's, in quote, menaced by a psychosis. He wrestles with what's happening in this eruption of unconscious psychic material in himself. And this is where he takes a defining moment and enters into this in a direct experiential way, his techniques of active imagination and even amplification largely come out of this period of about 6 months of self-exploration. He comes out of it in April and decides he has to really change his life. He quits his position at the university. He resigns as president of the psychoanalytic community and really begins to go his own way. And he's still very troubled by his own internal state and what's happening to him, even though he's having a sequence of dreams by June of that year that are indicating that he is going through a healing process. And then he feels that he reaches great relief in August 1st of 1914 because, of course, World War I breaks out. And he feels like, oh, this is an objective event, what I was experiencing. It wasn't just a personal event.
Uh-huh.
But the truth of the matter is then he's caught on the horns of a dilemma. Is it personal private madness? Is it prophecy? Neither one of those is terribly acceptable to him. He doesn't really want to see himself as a prophet, nor as particularly insane. And so he wrestles with this really on and off over until 1928. And it's really when he gets from Richard Wilhelm the manuscript for The Secret of the Golden Flower. And he has a synchronistic event occurring at that time where he had just been doing some drawing for the Red Book, and it's this golden castle. And his drawing, even in his private journals, he writes that it has a curiously Chinese feel, and he doesn't know what to make of that. Shortly after, he receives this manuscript from Wilhelm in the mail, and he realizes pictorially he has a very similar image, and that there's a confirmation suddenly from a completely unexpected source of the internal experience that he's having.
Wow, and I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah, it's a wonderful set of stories, and it's really how the Red Book then closes with that movement. And so what I've come to understand is, and he, if you look in 28, he also started to, for the very first time, use the term synchronicity in his private teaching. And then in 1930, he first uses the term publicly at Wilhelm's memorial service. And what I think is going on there psychologically is that the dilemma that he's had between madness and prophecy is now transcended. He has a third way of looking at it, that there's a kind of objective intuition that can be studied from a scientific perspective, what he tries to label synchronicity. He doesn't have the full scientific apparatus to bring that to bear, but he now has a philosophical position from which to get out of his dilemma by transcending it.
Yes. Yes. Now, the word synchronicity to me suggests simultaneity. Am I right that this issue of time is something that Jung struggled with, and how did he resolve it?
Well, I think he misstepped a little bit. You're absolutely right that he at first was talking about the simultaneity, because I think it was the appearance of things that juxtaposed that caught his attention, and he gives some clinical examples like the woman he's doing analysis with, and she's rather stuck, and she has a dream of a golden beetle piece of jewelry, and at just that moment a beetle shows up at the window.
Yes.
Yeah, here's your beetle.
Yeah, right.
And that's the kind of simultaneity he was thinking of, but I believe when you look more carefully at the project, you can't stay in linear time in that simplistic way. That's why I've begun to move more and more towards an emergent model rather than synchronicity, because you get caught in this thing. And even something like a precognitive dream would not work, because in that way you're having the time displacement go on. You've dreamt at night, and it's a day or 2 days or 3 days later that you find the reality. So they're not happening simultaneously, unless you talk about a very Einsteinian world where space and time have been warped very significantly. And Jung didn't work that out. So I'm less comfortable with the Chronos side of this.
Yeah, in fact, one of the things you say in the first chapter is that Jung lacked the background in physics and math to firmly establish what he was intuitively reaching for.
Yes, absolutely. He was a much better biologist than he was a hard scientist in the sense of math and physics. But that's where he had the relationship with Wolfgang Pauli that I think guided him on one hand, probably also pushed him a little bit, perhaps prematurely, to publish this. Because, you know, they decided to publish this. If you read the letters between Jung and Pauli, that correspondence is available now. You can see that Pauli is pushing to have this material disseminated because he feels it's part of the new physics that he's so involved in. And I think for Jung, the pressure came because he just had two heart attacks in the 40s. And I think he was really feeling the press of time for himself and the opportunity for he and Pauli to put something out. He, I think, saw a limited time window for himself. Mm-hmm. Ironically, of course, Pauli dies first.
Here's a passage in the first chapter that really struck me. You write, behind the theory of correspondence, Jung locates the classical world's notion of the sympathy of all things. In this, he turns to the Greek physician Hippocrates, and then you quote Hippocrates, and it was this quote from Hippocrates that really struck me. And you quote Hippocrates as saying, there's one common flow, one common breathing. All things are in sympathy. The whole organism and each one of its parts are working in conjunction for the same purpose. The great principle extends to the extremist part, and from the extremist part, it returns to the great principle, to the one nature, being and not being. Wow. That goes back to the Greeks. And of course, you mentioned Zen earlier. It also is very suggestive of Eastern insights.
Yes, I think that there's an awful lot of parallels and correlations. And in fact, that's one of the values of Jung, is that he serves as a kind of a linchpin or link between some of those philosophical traditions.
This notion of everything being connected also relates to the archetypes and what's referred to as the psychoid archetype. Mm-hmm. And that's one I really struggle with. I don't know if we can handle that in the space here. Can you help us to understand that?
Well, what Jung was looking at, what he was trying to describe, was something about the relationship between mind and matter. He was a monist in that sense. That is, that he didn't think mind and matter were fundamentally two separate things. And the psychoid was an attempt to say, well, if you follow the psyche down, I mean, obviously you get to the psychosomatic realm of experience fairly quickly. You know, if you're doing medical work, the mind-body relationship shows up in illness all the time. So already you can see that psyche is influencing soma, and soma is probably influencing psyche. And he's looking to get to the point where those two things blur and blend into one another, so that matter starts to have some psychological-like properties, mm-hmm. and the psyche seems to have a kind of a substance in the world. That was the fundamental idea. I think behind it, more deeply for me, I've gone more and more in the direction of what Jung was trying to do was a kind of cosmology here.
Yes.
And I really think what he's after is... I mean, I'm interested in the question of origin. So if you look at things like the Big Bang and so forth, of course, energy and matter are not separated at the very first instance. It takes, you know, as the universe expands in those first very, very minuscule amounts of time, 10 to the minus 40 second of a second, let's say, nothing is distinguished in that. And then in the next, you know, to about 10 to the minus 30 second of a second, you start to get things like gravity being a separate entity from the other forces in the universe. And as you get a series of breaks, as things break out and emerge, that is, properties, the very tendency to form patterns itself seems to be a fundamental property of our universe. That is, that things, when you break a bit of symmetry and things become more complex and you have different parts that are forming, out of that you get this sense of emergence. And that tendency for the pattern breaking, the symmetry breaking, pattern formation itself is, I think, what the psychoid is.
And so that's got something to do with the birth of the archetypes, in a sense.
Yes, I think it is the sort of engine behind which the psyche itself will eventually come into being, mm-hmm. and with it the differentiation into archetypal patterns and so forth as a fundament for it.
Okay. Now moving along, chapter 2 goes more deeply into the interconnectedness of everything. And reviews the nascent field theory and ideas of holism, which provided a kind of background influence for Jung's thinking on synchronicity. So maybe you can just tell us a bit about that transition of field theory and holism.
Yeah, well, I'm interested in this sense in the different strands of science. You know, with the rise of the scientific method in the 17th century, and you know, with the work especially of Newton, we moved very quickly during the Enlightenment into a reductive model, and that has enormous explanatory power. The alternative traditions that were more about looking at the gestalt of the whole were much more difficult to describe mathematically. In fact, they still are very difficult to put into any kind of precise language. And so for centuries, the reductive model held sway. But in the 19th century, there was a recurrence of the interest in things that seem to be interacting at a distance without any obvious intervening material or force. And of course, that's electricity and magnetism were the two first fields that were discovered by scientists. And when you start to move into things like electricity and magnetism, you don't have the discrete particulate form. Mm-hmm. That you have in, like, say, an atomic theory, you have fields of force. So you begin to look at a holistic set of interactions of everything that's in the field. Everything is then connected through the field. And so this is not just a sort of a new age form of holism. It's a kind of hard scientific evidence that began to evolve. It goes from the discovery of electricity and magnetism and their interrelationship through Oersted, and then on to Faraday, and of course Maxwell and his equations, on to Einstein, who is probably the greatest of the field theorists. And then in when you get into the 20th century with Einstein and quantum mechanics, then you start to have some very interesting fields, because quantum particles don't behave in a simplistic either reductive particle or a wholly field model, that is a kind of wave model. They in fact seem to, depending on how you set your experiments, you end up seeing either or both properties.
You also talk about religious convictions that some of these early scientists had, and how, you know, we talk about how the observer impacts the observed. And I was really getting a feel for that in this chapter when you talk about the impact of holistically oriented religious convictions on early science and philosophy. And for example, you talk about Newton's intense involvement with alchemy. I never heard that Newton was an alchemist in to some degree, and Leibniz's conviction that all the monads in his system had to mirror all the others in order to fit his kind of a priori notion of a balanced universe.
Yes, we actually know that Newton wrote much more on alchemy than he did on physics. I mean, there's Betty Jo Dobbs Teeter at Harvard produced several books on that, Hunting the Green Lion and the something about the Janus face, about Newton's alchemical work. It's a tradition that's just now beginning to be recovered in the last 15, 20 years. People are beginning to really study more carefully the biographies of these scientists. And these were the things that were left in the shadows, but in fact, there's far more evidence of these early pioneers having more complex interests.
That's really fascinating, because I think myself, and I suspect many others, just when we start talking about the alchemists, they just seem really sort of quaint and outmoded, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, yes. I mean, in terms of a literal theory of matter, it's not terribly effective. However, as a something that held a folk notion of transformation, I think then it becomes extraordinarily interesting, because up until the contemporary world, the idea of the things could be transformed and transmuted one into the other was a projection of one's psychological needs onto the world.
And so I'm getting the impression that it's not just that the observer influences his observations, but also perhaps all of science is pervaded by intuitive archetypal ideas. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And there are some historians of science and some rather renowned ones who are looking more at the psychology of the discovery, that how could anyone really be outside of their culture, outside of the kind of imagination of their world? I mean, some of them help us transcend that, but the metaphors that they use are drawn from the world that they live in. And therefore, at least as a psychologist and as a Jungian, I would say that there are archetypal determinants that sort of give energy to the choices, they lend a sort of psychological intensity of interest.
Yeah, there's a way in which that makes sense to me. I've long thought that the way that they teach us about the practice of science is somehow idealized. They paint it as scientists being totally objective, and they test their hypotheses, and if the hypothesis doesn't work out, then they reject that idea. But it seems to me that in practice what happens is the great scientists, at least, have a tenacious conviction about what is going on, really, and they just keep at it and keep at it despite all kinds of disconfirmations until they kind of figure a way in to validate what they intuitively grasped to start with.
Yes, that's often the case. There are a number of Nobel laureates who have been interviewed on the use of their imagination, how they've found their way into their subject matter through first imagining, you know, the way Einstein as a boy would imagine riding on a light beam. And this becomes then the motif for his entire scientific career later. It's curious how even as children, sometimes they have these great intuitions that carry them throughout a life. And I think the other thing in the last chapter, when we get there, it's the role of serendipity in scientific discovery that also is extremely important.
Yes, yes, and I want to ask you about that when we get there.
Okay.
You point out how this idea of interconnectedness of everything has ancient roots and keeps cropping up, from Indra's net to Leibniz's monads.
Yes.
Briefly sketch out those two, because everyone may not be quite familiar with them.
Sure. Well, what I was looking for are historical analogies to some of these field concepts, and I was very struck. I have some interest in the East and in the Flower Garland Sutra, which some people feel was probably the Buddha's first sutra. He tells a story of Indra's net, and it's the god Indra, and it's a metaphor where he describes an interconnected universe that it says it's like a spider's web, where at each intersection of the web points, there's a jewel, and each jewel reflects all of the other jewels in the entire net, so that the net itself is a self-reflecting structure that illuminates itself and keeps everything in relationship to all other parts of the entire universe. And then we move to, well, Leibniz had a Baroque Hall of Mirrors, and the mirror as an object was just entering daily life. It had been, before that, it had been rather seen as a kind of magical thing. It had not been able to be mass produced. And just in the 17th century, the technologies were such that they were becoming more common. And there was a whole notion of using halls of mirrors to get reflections to infinity, mm-hmm. and being able to see things reflected one into the other without end that I think was the defining metaphor there that captured Leibniz's imagination.
And your description of interest net makes me think of holograms, where is it the yes. hologram or holograph? I get the two mixed up, but the whole is contained in each part.
That's right. Yes, I mean if you take a holographic image done in a crystal, and if you break that in half, the entire image is still there. It's just your resolution is cut.
Yeah, fascinating. Now things really start to get interesting in chapter 3, where you go into complexity theory and emergence. So take us through these two concepts, if you will.
Well, these are concepts that come really out of use of high-speed computers to help us with problems that were insoluble before, starting with really the work on weather systems. And this led, of course, to chaos theory, where we began, you know, trying to predict the weather is, in a way, an impossibility. And the question was, once you had high-speed computers, could you begin to do some modeling? And some of those early attempts, began to show that very minor changes in initial conditions, what you start with, could get you going off in one direction or another and end up in radically different places. This is the so-called butterfly effect, where yes. The wings of a butterfly flap in one place in the world and you get a hurricane as a result someplace else. And then this is where the Santa Fe Institute people come in. They began to look at, and of course computers had gotten a little more sophisticated by then, they start looking at problems that are insoluble from a strictly mathematical point of view, but can be modeled and simulated. And so you try to get closer and closer to the result by seeing if you can make better simulations. And in fact, through their studies like that, they were able to do some rather remarkable modeling, and they made a number of predictions from the models, and out of that they began to develop a theory that could begin to describe systems where the particles are interacting with one another, whatever they are, whether people or atoms, and if they interact in a competitive environment, they have the capacity to self-organize. And once they start to self-organize, then of course you get new properties that are completely unexpected. That's what emergence is. Part of what they were trying to solve is the question of the origins of life. Because once you have life present, the evolutionary model that goes back to Darwin is a very good model. The problem is it doesn't give you a clue as to how did things first begin. And that's what they were trying to model.
Yeah, I love some of the examples you give from the insect world of emergence, where you have tiny units, tiny yes. insect units.
And, that's right.
And some kind of overall intelligence behavior emerges out of the group without it being coded in any one individual. Maybe you can share with us the example of the bees that you gave, because I thought that one was totally mind-blowing.
Yeah, this is the one about the beetle larvae. This was something I picked up in some scientific publications, had nothing to do with psychology. These are beetle larvae from the Mojave Desert that they tend to clump. A number of them sort of all get onto a little branch, and there are pictures of these. They make a kind of a lumpy shape that apparently looks enough like a female bee and gives off the right pheromone that male bees try to come and mate with this clump. And in the process, these beetle larvae, which are effectively parasitic, attach themselves, some of them, to the chest hairs of the male bee. And then when the male bee leaves and he carries them along to an actual mating event with a female, they transfer onto her back. They're carried by her to the hive, where they then eat the pollen. And if they don't do this, this is what's remarkable, if they don't do this, they can't complete their life cycle. So that the creation of this bee-like structure is an emergent form, that there's no image inside of these little creatures to build a bee, and there's nobody telling them how to do this. This is a spontaneous self-organization into that form.
Wow. I'm really struggling to wrap my mind around that.
Well, I think that's what these things that with emergence are like. I mean, they hit us at the level of mystery, and they don't come with an explanation. You know, you observe these things in nature, and you go, my goodness, this is as much of a mystery as the notion of synchronicity.
Yeah, you know, this makes me too think of in jungle environments and so on in earlier times, people learned that certain plants have certain healing properties and that, you know, and it's hard to buy that it all just happened through trial and error.
Yes.
You get the sense there was some other organizing principle somewhere at work.
Well, certainly in the medieval world, there was what was called a doctrine of signatures. And it was an intuitive model. And you looked at the world. It was a way of looking at the plants or animals in the world and seeing in that presentation of form an intuition of their purpose.
Yeah.
And the question is whether shamanic traditions opened up something of that level of intuition that began to be useful in terms of observing animals and plants in the world and finding the medicinal ones.
And you also, you spoke about symmetry. And why is symmetry and or asymmetry important for a model of synchronicity? I mean, it seems like, whoa, we're just getting way far afield here.
Yeah. Well, it really has to do with coming from a cosmological standpoint. I mean, there are multiple strands that brought me to that, but the breaking of symmetry is, for all of these systems that we're talking about, the breaking of symmetry is how increased complexity occurs. If you take any system that's interacting in this way to create a form that has more possibilities that emerge out of it, you can only get to those by lowering the amount of symmetry. You have to break the symmetry.
Mm-hmm. So it's basically the notion that destruction and creation are kind of married to each other. That
absolutely,
you can't have something new without destroying something old.
That's right. There has to be some sacrifice that you have to lose something of that. You can think of a mother-infant dyad as being in a kind of, at least in some moments, a very intense, symmetric, sort of oceanic world. And it takes something from the outside to break that pair up. And that's how consciousness emerges.
Now, in chapter 4, you go on to discuss empathy, which I guess brings us now to the sort of human realm. And maybe a kind of resonance, a kind of maybe a relationship to field theory. In fact, you invoke both field theory and the latest research on mirror neurons. So
yeah.
Take us through that.
Well, it seems to me that in looking at what is empathy is a way of knowing the world, a way of experiencing both other people and experiencing other aspects of the world. It's a way we internalize, we take something into ourselves and more deeply try to discover how it works, how we can come to an understanding of it, including the mind of others. And empathy seems to have been, it's a term that really is rather recent in Western thought. It really only goes back to the later part of the 19th century, where in German thought the term was Einfühlung, a feeling at one with something. And it was quickly recognized that this was a form of exploration of the world, a kind of introspective tool. Where it's gone in and out of favor over the course of the last century, but what's been particularly interesting was in the early part of the 1990s, there was a group of researchers in Italy at the University of Parma who were doing some experiments on monkeys. They were looking at the motor neurons. They were trying to understand how the brain-body interface works and the way motion is portrayed within the neurology of the brain. And serendipitously, somebody left the equipment on, at least this is the story, apocryphally, somebody left the equipment on during lunch, and suddenly they saw the neurons that they were studying firing, and yet the monkey was at rest. And so this was a really perplexing sort of thing that they had the good sense to investigate once they realized this wasn't due to a failure of their equipment. And what they discovered was there were a small class of neurons that fire when the monkey performed an action and when the monkey observed an action. In other words, this is something that was linking inner and outer worlds, both what came from within the self in terms of an action and what was being brought in from the outside.
So in other words, if a monkey saw another monkey performing a certain action, the neurons would fire just as they would if the first monkey had done those actions himself or herself.
Exactly, and that's why the term mirror neurons was applied. And from there, the people who were working in the human psychology began to look for some of these same kind of neurons within the human system, and indeed they were discovered in particularly interesting areas. But the point was that these were recognized as, at a very low level in a way, communicative tools, and that these might be the very basis for empathy. It's the way we internalize something from the outside so we come to understand it within ourselves.
And so what's the relationship between that and synchronicity, since that's the central topic of the book?
Yeah, well, it takes a little bit more work to get to that, but I think that what you've got is with the mirror neurons and empathy, you're looking at a field phenomena. First off, and so we're moving back in that direction of a holistic field, and we can see then when there are these moments of coincidence, this kind of resonant mirroring really is what's going on. And what is synchronicity but a kind of a mirroring of an inner event and an outer event? We're in very close. We're saying that in a way, synchronicity is a form of objective empathy. That there's a coincidence between the outer object and the inner experience. And this might be a kind of way to begin to enter this from the neurological perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, I'm getting a little away from the acausal view of synchronicity here.
Yes, yes. And as if it weren't complex enough already, you enlarge your scope to talk in the final chapter, you enlarge your scope to talk about cultural synchronicities and serendipities, and you give some examples from the history of science. So maybe you can take us through the highlights of that, and particularly what the differentiation is between those two words, synchronicity on the one hand and serendipity on the other.
Okay. Well, first off, with cultural synchronicities, I was interested in looking at sociological or cultural historical events that had a synchronistic core to them. I mean, the first one that had come to my attention was some of what happened between Cortez and Moctezuma that led to the conquest of America. I won't take the time to go through the details, but it's chock full of very odd coincidences that without which the story would have looked very different. And then you begin to realize that this is a story that has that kind of core that unfolds over the next 400 or 500 years, so that we can't just locate the event. We can say it's a kind of an originary event that happens in the 15th century, but it then moves very quickly in waves out over the course of time, and it continues to resonate. And so my question, were there other events? And the more I began to look and collect these, I looked at the origins of Greek democracy as another place with the rearrangement of the city of Athens and along new tribal lines that produced an emergent structure that was really part of the flowering of Athens. And I can see in there a kind of cultural synchronicity. And then I began to look at some of the serendipitous discoveries in medicine and in science, because as a scientist, I had myself had several experiences of serendipity in the sense of discovering something you weren't looking for. It's you make a significant discovery by accident, but it's only the open, well-trained mind that will recognize that something meaningful and interesting has happened, like the business with the mirror neurons. Many people could have just discarded that as mechanical failure or something that was just an annoyance that was getting in the way of the actual experiment. It takes a bit of real perception and depth of openness to grasp that you've got something new here, unexpected. And so I look at a couple of those things, like the discovery of penicillin and so forth, that has layers of these kinds of serendipitous discoveries. And then the question is, as you ask, what's the relationship between serendipity and synchronicity? And that's one I don't feel like I've fully worked out yet.
Okay. We're getting to the borders of your own understanding. You know, and what you were just saying makes me think of what I think has been observed, that when there are these major sort of scientific periods of paradigm shift, that they're also echoed in art and in religion and in philosophy. It's as if there were a wave of change permeating everything.
Yeah, that's why the cultural piece seems so significant. I think you're absolutely right that if these things are truly happening, if it's like an archetypal pattern constellating in a culture, then you would expect multiple ramifications of that and cutting across all these different disciplines. And it's only by, in a way, reassembling some of the streams that you begin to get a larger picture.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can pull back and give us the view from 40,000 feet, because we've discussed everything from archetypes to field theory to relativity and the nature of time to mirror neurons and empathy. After all this wide-ranging research, what's your view of synchronicity?
Well, I think it's still something not well understood. First off, I mean, I don't feel like I feel like this is a step in a direction. It's not a definitive statement. Mm-hmm. It's what my feeling is that we still have a mystery here that requires us to continue our research, to continue to look. I have some thoughts about the way you could do some experiments that might help clarify some of the questions that are still open.
Yes, you give some suggestions along the way that maybe doctoral students should pay close attention to.
Well, it just feels to me that there are possibilities here that culturally we're just reaching this place. I mean, you know, people say that the 21st century is the century of the brain, perhaps. And, of course, the best model for the brain-mind relationship is really an emergent model, that the mind emerges from the brain. And so what I'm trying to do with this is to also suggest that some of what Jung's intuitions were about 75 years in advance of where culture was.
Mm-hmm.
And that we now have some of the tools to begin to look at that, and we should re-examine some of his ideas in that context.
You know, Jung talked about little dreams and big dreams, and I think we've all learned about that distinction. I'm wondering, are there little synchronicities and big synchronicities?
Yes, you know, my feeling on that, and some C.A. Meyer, one of Jung's disciples early on, suggested that the mind-body relationship might have a synchronistic dimension to it, which would be a much lower level. I don't want to go off into a lot of science here, but there's something called a power law where you look at the frequency and intensity relationship, and under the right mathematical conditions, if you get a straight line in a plot, it tells you that at different levels of intensity, you have the same phenomena going on, only some are big, some are little, in the way that you're talking about that, like earthquakes, whether it's 2 on the Richter scale or a 10. The actual experience, of course, is radically different. You know, you barely feel a shake at 2, whereas at 10, the world's crashing down around you. But I think synchronicities could have a similar kind of structure to them.
Yeah, well, I think so, just from my own personal experience, that there are kind of things that feel like little synchronicities, and others that just feel so astounding and have so much rich meaning embedded in them.
Yes, and I think as anyone who works clinically will see these kinds of things occurring in the course of therapy. There are little moments, you know, where curious little things. I have more recently started to talk about moments of complexity, where, you know, in terms of a therapy relationship, where curious, odd little coincidences will happen. Sometimes they'll build up to something rather major that may be even life-transforming for people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that maybe we could just briefly touch on what's a really big question, which is the utility of synchronicities in therapy. I mean, how do you use synchronicities when they're reported in therapy?
Yeah, that, as you say, that is a huge question. The first thing I would say is that something like emergence, which I'm going to use as a kind of backstop for synchronicity, is value neutral. That is, it doesn't come with a sense that this is necessarily a good or a bad thing. And so one of the things I think when you're looking at synchronistic-like or emergent phenomena in therapy is that one has to still wrestle with the morality of it, that one doesn't immediately assign a positive value because it has a kind of wow factor to it.
I wonder if Hitler had great synchronicities.
Well, you know, this, I would say that Nazism was itself an emergent phenomenon in the German culture, and it was a rather dark one.
Well, that's an interesting place for us to kind of close. I wonder, as we wind down, I wonder if there are any final points that you'd like to make.
Well, again, I think that, it may be a place where East and West can meet. You know, the Jung's, move into synchronicity was facilitated by these ancient texts from the East. And I've recently spent some time in China, and I'm struck by how quickly and thoroughly the Chinese pick up complex systems. You know, that their culture seems to be adapted more in that direction. And, you know, we have a more scientific language for it. They have almost a more well-developed cultural intuition. So it may be a way in which our world can become more connected.
Well, that's fascinating, and it's hopeful. And hope is a good thing.
Well, yes, I think so. I think we all could use a bit of that.
Yeah. Well, I hope this didn't feel too much like your oral exams as a doctoral student or becoming a Jungian analyst here. I kind of had that feeling part way through. So, Dr. Joseph Cambray, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, Dave. It was a pleasure talking with you.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Joseph Cambray. I have to say, I feel really privileged to have been able to spend time with a scholar of his stature, as well as someone who is perhaps at the pinnacle of the Jungian world in his capacity as president of the International Association of Analytical Psychology. As you heard, I read a passage or two from the book during the interview. Here's another passage I was particularly struck by. He writes, quotes, "In discussing individuation, becoming more fully oneself, Jung repeatedly points out that this is not a form of perfectionism, but is about completeness. It requires finding ways to deal with all aspects of one's personality, positive and negative. Because Jung includes the undesirable aspects of personality, both individual and collective, the holistic goal tends to differ from that of morality, which is commonly found in many philosophical or religious systems that emphasize seeking only the good in oneself and the world." Close quote. Now, this seems to me like such a key tenet of the Jungian approach to individuation, that it's not about reaching some state of perfection, but rather coming into one's full self. I think it's easy for us to either miss or forget that point. This last point is a little bit of a detour from the topic of synchronicity, but it's an example of the many unexpected gems a reader will encounter in Dr. Cambray's book. It's not a huge tome, only 5 chapters spread out over 169 pages. It's clearly written, but also a very challenging read. For those of you brave enough to take it on, it will definitely stretch your conceptual boundaries and deepen your understanding of the frontiers of Jungian theory. I do recommend it and also suggest that you use the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar of our site. There's even an affordable Kindle version, which is how I read it on my various iDevices.
Don't let the podcast well run dry. Keep these outstanding podcasts coming and support Dr. Dave by going to the website and clicking on the big green donate button. If we can all remember to make a donation, it will mean the difference between always having new and captivating interviews to listen to or not. Donate as much as you like, and in that way, Dr. Dave will be able to continue on his journey to educate, entertain, nurture, and inspire.
Thank you, Sherry West. Perhaps you've been noticing these very professional-sounding promos in which I've been acknowledging Sherry West and Michael West. Well, I'll let you in on a little secret. Sherry is my sister, and Mike is her husband. They live in Baja, California, and they run a business out of their home called Sales on Hold. They create the sorts of voiceover messages that you've been hearing here for companies to have customers to listen to when they are put on hold on the phone. I'm sure you've had that experience at some time or other. I don't know why it took me so long to think of asking if they could come up with something for Shrink Wrap Radio. I gave them about 13 key themes, and they very generously created 13 promos for me with a different version in each of their voices. I really appreciate the professional polish that they've added and the fact that it relieves me from having to beg for your support. So do click on that big green donate button. I can't resist it. And thanks to all of you who have done so. Apple Computer has just brought out a new free podcast app designed to help people find and listen to podcasts. It's for all iPhones, iPods, and iPads, in other words, iOS devices. It's just called Podcasts, and it's free. You can get it in the App Store. It looks like a very good app, and all of you iDevice folks should check it out. Of course, I'd still prefer that you use our Shrink Wrap Radio app for this show, and you can find that info on the Apps tab at the Shrink Wrap Radio website. However, I primarily bring this up because I immediately searched for Shrink Wrap Radio in what they call the catalog and was thrilled to find it listed in the top 5 shows under What's Hot under the higher education category. So help keep us there by continuing to spread the word among your friends and colleagues about Shrink Wrap Radio. Thanks to listener Jeremy Devins, we have a new transcript on the site. It's Shrink Wrap Radio number 270, Unlocking Psychological Wealth with Robert Biswas Diener. That's a really upbeat episode. Thanks so much, Jeremy, for doing that. I've just returned from 5 days at the International Association for the Study of Dreams 29th Annual Conference at the Berkeley Marina in California. We had beautiful weather. I had beautiful accommodations overlooking a harbor with lots of sailboats. I was pleased to be discovered by about 5 different listeners there who came up and introduced themselves. I'm now suffering from overstimulation and decompression as I return to normal reality. It was a wonderful conference, and I made a number of new friends. And in case they hear this, I especially want to mention Tamar, Bonnie, Orr, Ashley, Shani, Injiri, Laura, Kelly, Greg, and Sven. Now I'm feeling very inspired about conducting a dream group in Stockholm, Sweden, on September 7, 8, and 9. I've already got my airline reservation. And also planning on conducting an online dream group. And you'll be hearing more about both of these in the future.
Hey, this is Matt Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, son Matthew. We're keeping it all in the family today. Now let's listen to two recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Dr. George Lau, whom it was my privilege to interview about somatic experiencing on Wise Counsel podcast. He writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. This morning I listened to your podcast where you were interviewed, the podcast where you were the guest. I absolutely loved it. You could have gone on talking about your life for 4 hours, and I would have remained attentive and fascinated. You always wanted to write another book, and I think the book you could write would be a memoir, if maybe you dictated it to someone like you do in this interview. You are a natural raconteur. What an amazing group of stories you told. I remember reading Woody Guthrie's Bound for Glory in 1968 or 69 and feeling so sorry for him because of his mother's mental illness. I'm hoping you'll have someone interview you again sometime. I sent notice of the interview you did of me on somatic experiencing to the group, and they are publicizing it. My students wrote 180 pages of papers on the podcast they listened to, and they really seemed to get a lot out of it, and many of them said they will continue to listen to Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel. So you've got some new fans. I think I will continue requiring this assignment in my future classes. All the best." And that's from George Lau, PhD. Well, I hope it's not too self-serving to read this note here, but this feedback is especially meaningful coming from a professional peer and one whom I really bonded with during our interview and have a lot of respect for. And George, I also really appreciate your helping to get the word out about Shrink Wrap Radio and assigning it to your students. And I encourage all other professors, lecturers, teachers out there to consider doing the same. Now, this next one is from my sister, Sherry, who I mentioned earlier. And I can't help but feel a bit self-serving sharing this one with you, but I'm going to take the plunge anyway. Sherry writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Just finished listening to the above referenced podcast, and I must say, you're a wonderful storyteller. I'm hesitant to lavish you with compliments and praises because you no doubt feel that I'm too biased to be objective and that I love every word out of your mouth, and because we share some of the same DNA, experiences, relatives, etc. But really, David, I too went to the University of Skepticism, and I too am a tough nut to crack. So when I tell you what a great interview it was, damn it, you better believe it, baby. I'm a great judge of what's authentic, and I always will be able to tell what's appealing to the masses. No matter how old I get, my finger will still be on the public's pulse, and my point of view is wide angle enough to see what's coming down the pipeline. And I don't fake it, that is, enthusiasm, for anybody, especially you. Did I mention that I was modest, too? The interviewer was very taken with you, too. The synchronicity of finding your biological dad was pretty amazing, and although I had a basic knowledge of the events that led towards your finding him, the detailed re-account, especially the synchronicities, was captivating, spellbinding, and enthralling. I got choked up when you spoke of the vivid dream of you being an actor on stage, and the prop phone rings, you answer only to hear Daddy on the other end, with such a profound and enigmatic message. I've never heard from him in the dream state, but would love to. Then the interview broke in to tell you about an American Indian she interviewed, Lakota to be exact, saying that he told her that the meaning, and I'm paraphrasing here, of such dreams can have different meanings at different stages in your life depending upon how far up the karma spiral you are. I almost fell off my exercise bike. I just knew you were going to tell her that Daddy was predominantly of American Indian descent, Sioux, among others, who collectively are called the Lakota, Nakota, and Dakota, and that maybe Daddy's afterlife words of wisdom were from his Indian ancestry meant for you at a later time in your life, after you had finished your father quest, albeit unknown to you at the time of delivery, but known to him, and known to him that you would be able to interpret it later in life when your karma was more evolved, which it currently is. I just knew a synchronistic tie-in with the American Indian Lakota reference was forthcoming in the conversation, but apparently it was only synchronous in my mind, or maybe it would have been too difficult to explain after stating earlier that he was black. I applaud you for being able to talk that long with no commercial breaks, bathroom breaks, or water, and to keep it moving, fresh and interesting, not to mention self-revealing. I don't think I was ever aware of one or ah. All I can say is bravo for taking such a complicated and long story and weaving it into a condensed and fascinating Reader's Digest version of your life story. I'll bet your shrink wrap radio audience loved it. And thanks for the voiceover credit. Love, Sherry. And then she adds a P.S. Love the interviewer's observation that an Irish accent would enhance the "and just enough to make you dangerous" tag. I think she's right on. Mike does a great Irish accent. And that, of course, is referring to her husband, Mike West. So again, it may be self-serving to share the lavish praise from both George and my sister Sherry, but it so confirmed my somewhat risky-feeling decision to put that piece of my autobiography out there that I again just feel I have to share it with you all. I think Sherry has only recently started listening to some of these podcasts, and so you can imagine it's especially meaningful to me that she is sharing this part of my life with me. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. And don't forget, you can also use our iOS app and Android app, and you can get full details about those on the website. Just look for the apps tab. Thanks to Jungian analyst Dr. Joseph Cambray for sharing his deep insights into the history and nature of synchronicity. His observations strike me as especially timely and meaningful in the context of the series of my own personal synchronicities and email reactions that we've just been discussing. I'm not absolutely certain we'll be able to pull it off in time for the next episode, but I'm hoping the next one will be with Dr. Billy Baum on behaviorism and religion. That should be pretty interesting, hey? So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.